This treaty will set the stage for further cuts. And going forward, we hope to pursue discussions with Russia on reducing both our strategic and tactical weapons, including non-deployed weapons.
President Obama in Prague earlier this morning as he signed the new nuclear arms control treaty with Russia. With us now is the chief of U.S. Naval Operations, Admiral Gary Ruffhead. As chief of operations, naval operations, he serves on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. His predecessor as naval chief was Admiral Mike Mullen, now chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And with the nuclear arms treaty signing by President Obama and many other things going on, we have a lot that we could talk about. Admiral, very nice of you to come out to our studios. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you very much.
President Obama's official nuclear weapons policy for the United States, revised this week, says we will never use nuclear weapons against a non-nuclear nation, even if they attack us with other weapons of mass destruction, so long as they are in compliance with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. What does that change mean for the Navy?
Well, I think for the Navy, there's quite very little change. We are one leg of our nation's nuclear triad, and I would say the most survivable leg because it's based on our submarines. And our job is to make sure that that leg of the triad is ready. But I do believe that the treaty that has been signed is a terrific step in the president's objective of reducing reliance on nuclear weapons and reducing proliferation. So it's really a terrific step forward.
The president also announced that no new nuclear weapons would be designed. Good idea?
I believe that the reliability of our stockpile is important, and that's where our focus is to make sure that the weapons that we have today is a stockpile that's reliable, and I believe that is a positive step as well.
Under the treaty, will you have to supervise dismantling of any nukes under the Navy's control?
Not directly. Those are handled by different agencies within the government. My responsibilities really deal with making sure that our submarines and the weapons that we have are ready, that they're safe, and that they're secure.
As a matter of policy, I hear the president getting criticized from the left, criticizing from the right now on the nuclear posture review. Personally, I can't imagine the U.S. dropping a nuclear bomb on anyone for any reason, even if some rogue country or terrorist dropped a nuclear bomb on us. A nuclear weapon seems to me like a weapon of state terrorism because it would inevitably kill so many civilians and not probably have a military usefulness that couldn't be accomplished in other ways. Should I not view it that way, in your opinion?
Well, I believe that the importance of our deterrent is significant. It has served our nation well for a long time. And the deterrent posture of our nuclear forces is something that I take very seriously and that we maintain in a very high state of readiness and security. But I also do believe that deterrence is also a function of our conventional forces. And that's what the Navy does day in and day out in every ocean of the world, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so it's our conventional deterrence that I think is important as well.
Just to go a step further on this, Hiroshima and Nagasaki were, in the U.S.'s view, to avoid mass troop casualties when wars were fought that way. Give me a modern scenario, any plausible scenario, no matter how far from it we may be today, under which you could envision the U.S. justifiably using a nuclear weapon?
Well, Brian, I don't speculate on scenarios where nuclear weapons would be used or would not be used. I think it's important to recognize the role that our nuclear deterrent plays in maintaining a peaceful environment in the world that we live in. And so to speculate on when it would be used or not used, I just don't go there.
Even just to describe what the term deterrent means in a real sense?
Well, I would say in a real sense, the term deterrent means that the capacity, the capability is there that would dissuade others from wanting to use weapons of mass destruction.
Because presumably we would what? As a matter of retaliation, drop a nuclear bomb on you?
Well, I think that the president has been quite clear in how he is approaching this, and those who are adhering to the international norms that have been set forth need not worry about this. Again, I don't speculate on this.
U.S. Chief of Naval Operations Gary Roughead, my guest on WNYC. Am I mistaken, by the way, that the chiefs of the other services get chief of staff and you are chief of U.S. Naval Operations? As somebody who lived in Norfolk for a few years, you know, that strikes me as maybe discrimination against the Navy.
Well, I think it could be the other way around. I think the title of Chief of Naval Operations is one that that I am honored to hold, and more honored to be able to lead the great young men and women of our Navy.
Let's go on to another topic about a non-nuclear cause of mass destruction in our society. I see in the news this week that the Navy is considering banning smoking on submarines, and I was surprised to learn that people could smoke on subs in that kind of enclosed environment. Why is it allowed, and why might you ban it now?
Well, I think clearly we have, as a Navy, have tried to dissuade smoking and unhealthy behavior like that, not just on our submarines but throughout our ships. But recently we have conducted some tests on some of our submarines, and because it's such a closed atmosphere, and even though we filter a lot of the air on the submarine, there are still significant contaminants that we have found that even for those who do not smoke, they are at great risk because of the smoke contaminants that remain in the atmosphere. We have looked at this, and we believe it's in the best interest of those who serve on our submarines to ban the smoking. Clearly, for those who smoke, this is a big deal. But I really do believe it is the right thing to do, and it's in the best interest of the health and safety of our people.
I read one piece of speculation that it might be related to allowing Navy women on subs at some time in the future. Some women's advocates, as you know, argue for that inclusion, but a recent study showed that submarine life could be hazardous to fetal development. Any relation between one and the other?
No, there really aren't. In fact, as we looked at the service of women on board submarines, that was one of the areas that had been identified in the past. We have looked at that. My Surgeon General, who is a superb physician, has viewed the risks as not significant. That doesn't mean that we're not going to continue to do research on our submarines as far as the health of all who serve on board. But that was something that we looked at very carefully, and I'm confident that it does not pose a risk to the young women who are very much looking forward to serving on board our submarine.
So this is something that's going to happen?
Women on submarines?
Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the young women that have come up to me since we've announced that change in the policy, there's great enthusiasm. For me, as the Chief of Naval Operations, knowing the great young women that we have serving in the Navy, as a former commanding officer of a ship that mixed the crew, that mixed the genders on a ship, to me, it would be foolish to not take the great talent, the great competence and intellect of the young women who serve in our Navy today and bring that into our submarine force.
On a related note then, somewhat, don't ask, don't tell.
Right.
A one-year review is underway. I gather you have been noncommittal so far as to whether you think it could work for the Navy to end don't ask, don't tell until after the review?
I'm very much in favor of doing this review because it will allow us to determine what our Navy believes, what our force believes. There are many comparisons to other navies. We are not other navies. Our demographic is different. The way we employ our force is different, and I believe it's important that we understand what the attitudes are of the young men and women who have volunteered to serve in our Navy. So I'm very much in favor of the assessment. It will inform us, it will inform me, so that I can provide my best military advice. And should Congress change the law, because that's what needs to happen to allow homosexuals to serve in the military. But should Congress change the law, this assessment will also inform us as to the types of things that we need to be thinking about.
What are the main questions that you need answered for yourself on that?
Well, I think for me, the issue is one of attitudes of men and women in uniform, and particularly for me, the Navy. But there's no question in my mind that if the law were to change today, those who wear this uniform will obey the law. But I want to be able to understand what the views are, the propensity to serve, the propensity to continue to serve as a result of a change that is not insignificant in our military today. So that would be very helpful to
me. So take me a step deeper if you can. If Don't Ask were to be repealed, how would you go about that integration process? You want to maintain cohesion and morale, and you were just saying recruitment and retention. So if that's the decision, what would be the main methods of implementing the change?
Well, there'd be no question that if the law were to change, that we would move forward. I think that there would have to be policies that would need to be examined with regard to the accommodations that exist on board our ships and submarines.
Separate housing?
With regard to the benefits that accrue, with regard to some of the domestic laws and how they would apply to a change in law as it applies to the military. So I think there are a lot of things like that that would have to change.
You mean there might be some kind of gay housing?
I would not say that, but I think the issues of the rights that would accrue to partners and things like that are areas that would be worked through.
The Naval Chief of Operations, Gary Roughead, my guest on WNYC. And we have a few minutes for phone calls for him. Get your calls in right away. You've heard Admiral Roughead speaking now for a few minutes on a number of topics. And we'll just have about 5 minutes to take phone calls for him. But if you get your calls right away, anything that we have discussed or anything else that you would want to bring up with the Naval Chief here this morning, short time for phone calls. And I'm going to ask everybody to keep your questions brief. This is not the time to make your speeches. We have plenty of time for that on this show. But when you call in with a question for Admiral Roughead, right to the point, if you have one, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And as calls are coming in, Admiral, on another topic, Yemen is in the news these days for reasons relating to terrorism, obviously. And Yemen was where the USS Cole was bombed a decade ago. And I've read that the Navy is now officially warning of a current al-Qaeda risk near Yemen. What kind of presence specifically are you warning of?
Well, there is no question that there is al-Qaeda activity and influence in Yemen. There have been threats that have been made with regard to that critical waterway that goes by Yemen called the Bab al-Mandeb. We continue to operate in that area. It's an area where, as you know, pirates have been active lately.
Is there a correlation between the relationship between pirates, which we think of as for economic thievery, and al-Qaeda?
There's speculation, but I've not seen anything that one could attribute to being a direct link. But there's always the potential, I think, when criminal activity exists for the different types of that criminal activity to come together in a harmful way. So we are vigilant. We have our forces there. And in fact, just last week, I happened to visit the USS Cole in Djibouti. And as you may recall, the Cole was the ship that was attacked in Aden Harbor in Yemen. But that crew did not give up the ship, and she's back operating, bringing security and safety and stability in that important part of the world.
Did you learn certain security lessons from the Cole bombing that make Navy ships in that area or anywhere safer from such small boat attacks now?
Absolutely. And we continue to learn. We continue to adopt best practices. We continue to monitor threats as they're reported. And it's something that is constantly evolving. And we place great, great priority on making sure that our crews are properly trained and prepared for threats such as that.
Elliot in Tarrytown, you're on WNYC with the Chief of Naval Operations, Gary Roughead. Hello.
Hi, how are you? There was a movie out a few years ago about partial communication to a nuclear submarine about launching nuclear missiles. And there was a disagreement between the captain and the exec about whether they should launch the missiles or not on a partial communication. How has the Navy dealt with that?
Well, Elliot, thank you for the question. And I can assure you that even before that movie was made, the communications and the redundancies that exist and the controls that do not allow any one individual to be able to make decisions as they apply to nuclear weapons The process that we go through to authenticate the appropriateness of those orders are extraordinarily extensive. They're extremely redundant, and I have total confidence in our ability to make sure that that is not corrupted in any way, shape, or form.
I heard a BBC report this morning that I think referred to a 23-year-old sailor who's the one who actually had his finger on the button at a certain moment that they were reporting on, and I think the USS New Orleans. Does that sound familiar?
Doesn't sound familiar to me, Brian. But with regard to our nuclear command and control, it is an absolutely extraordinarily redundant, safe, and secure system, and I have every confidence in it.
Greg in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello, Admiral Roughhead.
Greg, how are you?
I'm well. I served on active duty in the Army in the 80s, and I'm in the National Guard now. I've served in Iraq and Afghanistan. While I was in Afghanistan, I was surprised to see a large number of Navy personnel, medical personnel, cooks, computer techs, communication people. I thought it was bizarre that there were so many Navy people in a landlocked country in Central Asia. I'm wondering why that is. Does the Army not have enough of them?
Well, thanks, Greg. And I'm very, very proud of the contribution our Navy is making in Iraq, Afghanistan, and in other places. In fact, in the Middle East, I have more sailors serving on the ground than I do at sea. I have 12,000 sailors serving ashore. I refer to them as our sand sailors. And they are doing many of the tasks that you talked about. They're also leading provincial reconstruction teams. There are construction battalions. They're doing absolutely extraordinary work, making a difference and contributing to the joint force in a way that we can and that we're very proud of.
What's the definition, though? Why are Navy personnel in Afghanistan?
Well, the fact of the matter is that we're all in this together. There are capabilities that we have that may be in short supply in other services, and when the fight is on, we move to the sound of the guns.
The Navy doesn't have a mountain division, though, I presume.
No, but we lead in the mountains, and our SEALs are absolutely extraordinary in that environment.
Bruce in Yonkers, you're on WNYC with Admiral Roughhead. Hello.
Good morning, Admiral, and thank you, Brian, for taking the call. Admiral, you had mentioned that one of the several reasons that you wanted these studies to go forward regarding gays and lesbians in the military was that the demographics of the American Navy, and I guess armed forces generally, perhaps by extension, is really very different than other armed forces where gays and lesbians already serve. Could you unpack that a little bit as to what are these major differences in our demographics?
Sure, Bruce, and I appreciate the question. We are a different society than our European colleagues. We have different views. I think many of the young men and women who serve in our military, their faith is very important to them, and I think those are considerations that come into play. As an all-volunteer force, we also draw our men and women from parts of the country that one could say perhaps are a bit more conservative. Maybe they're not. That's why I think it's important to do this assessment, so that we understand who we are, what our young men and women believe themselves. And in fact, when I talk to my sailors about the assessment and the process we're going through, I make sure to tell them that this is an assessment that they must answer. It's not what their family thinks. It's not what their chief thinks. It's what they believe. And so I think it's important that we understand our force, the beliefs of our force. And as I said, ultimately it will be Congress that changes the law. And as we go through this assessment process, it will be informing us as to things that we have to be thinking about. Obviously, we've been considering what some of the implications and actions may be. But this is the first time that we have been able to assess the force. It is not the practice of the American military, as I'm sure you would agree, that we decide and take polls on the laws of the land. We are here to uphold the laws of the land, to abide by them. And so I think this is a very important assessment.
It sounds like you're spending a lot more time and mental energy getting ready to possibly implement the policy than arguing against it.
I want to find out what our force believes. And from that, I'll be able to give my best military advice. And then should Congress change the law, then I will be better informed and be able to lead the Navy in the appropriate way.
Last thing, the Navy's presence in Haiti. I know you've had hospital ships there since the earthquake. What's the latest?
Well, the latest, Brian, is that most of our naval forces have gone. Our hospital ship left a couple of weeks ago. But I could not be more proud of the way the Navy responded. We were the first ships on station, and in many cases, the first medical capabilities on station in Haiti. And as we have done over the years, over the decades, and indeed the centuries, we are able to respond quickly, bring relief and hope from the sea in ways that others can't. And the pride that our sailors take in being able to do that is something that that I hold our young men and women in awe.
The Chief of U.S. Naval Operations, Admiral Gary Roughead. Admiral, I hope we can speak again. Thank you so much for coming.
We look forward
in.
To that. Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, .Earth blogger Andrew Revkin joins us for his weekly Thursday appearance for through the month of April. Today, we're going to tackle the science of global warming, not the politics. We're going to try to actually explain what the uncertainties are in global warming science and how it should inform what steps we take. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.